you said that it was difficult to get money for postdocs at that time. How did your other colleagues at Columbia react to your having your own?
I have no idea how they reacted. I know that there was no unpleasant reaction to my face, but I'm not sure that there wasn't a certain amount of resentment. It was such a fabulous thing. But it didn't give me any trouble.
Mm-hmm. Your association with that continued well into the Yale years as well.
Yes. The lab must have closed down when, about 1959 or something of that sort. Again, one would have to...
59, yes.
Yeah. So it was, you know, just a flowering of about 12 years. It was really quite amazing.
What happened to the facilities after it?
Well, Ruth Alice very unhappily had a stroke a few years after it began. In fact, she was had dinner with Michael Dewar, or the Dewars, in London the evening before she had the stroke. And the after effects of that were certainly sufficient that she couldn't think of either of working in the laboratory or keeping an active interest in science. And then her husband died, and so it. The pleasure, if you will, that the whole operation had been giving her, and it was a great deal of satisfaction it was giving her, was in effect taken away by the stroke. So then the children, or her children, had very little interest in it and did not want to keep up the estate once it was clear that she'd be better off living in New York City. So they decided to close it down. And meanwhile, I had moved to New Haven in 52, and Larry Knox left very unhappily, having divorced his wife, and he went to Mexico City to work for Syntex. And so, in retrospect, you can see the small disintegrations in various parts of it. And in other words, the great spirit that kept it going and got it started and so forth, and held it together for, say, 9 or 10 years, then began to fall away. So they either gave or sold the whole estate to a private school out there, the Harvey School. They took over the laboratory as a place to teach science to their high school kids. Just a couple of years ago, I visited it. I mean, it was recognizable. But it's sort of run-down shadow of the intensely active place that it had been.
In addition to Knox, was Maitland Jones there also at one time?
Yes. His parents, Maitland and Irma Jones, lived in the next town, Bedford, and he, as a young boy, had shown an interest in science. The Joneses knew the Wiles, and so when the lab was set up, they came over to say, "Well, is there any possibility that you can take this little boy who?" Was either 12 or 14. Mate says he was 14. I say he was 12. and for this during the summer, and so Rhett knew I wouldn't be there all day long, and Larry said, "Oh, sure, that would be fine." And so he late started out. You know, he was still in toward the end of grammar school, I guess. And he remembers. See, it's amusing to talk to him because we were trying to figure what kind of things, you know, could this little boy do. We can't have him eating glassware all day long. So I taught him how to make melting point capillaries, or at least enough so that he could help. And so we'd get these huge tubes, and I would, you know, hold them in the flame and rotate them until it was a great mass. And then I'd give him one end and say, "Now run to the end of the laboratory," which he would do at top speed, and we would draw out yards of melting point capillaries. But I'm sure that little things like that, that clearly had nothing to do with chemistry, you know, with molecules, with chemical transformations or anything like that, for which he was much too young, nevertheless gave him tremendous boost and feeling of excitement about the whole thing. Just a little boy wandering around among postdocs. So then he went on to where? To Andover, and from Andover to Yale, by which time I was there, and he did his PhD work with me. And I was, you know, very close friends with the family, and so on. So that was an odd offshoot of the...
How did you find it separating your efforts between graduate students at Columbia, postdocs out at Katona? And as you said, you kept your problems sort of separate. The more daring ones you were doing out at Katona,
yes.
The ones you were pretty sure would get the student his degree, you were doing it. How did you keep that all sorted out?
Well, there was no problem keeping it sorted out in my own mind, but the people at Katona came to Columbia every week for the literature research seminar, and that meant to say that each one of them during a year would give a couple of talks, and these were modeled as well as I could after Woodward's problem solving seminars, and then every so often, particularly in the summer, the students at Columbia would come out to Katona for, you know, a big cookout. So actually the connection was very close between the two groups, and the quality of the seminars, needless to say, very much higher for having the postdocs taking part. And that comes back to what I feel is a very, very important part of the educational process, and so do a lot of other persons, that the competition that a graduate student has from fellow graduate students or from postdocs around them is crucial in setting the sights and the standards. And it's true in all sorts of activity, that, I mean, from tennis through to chemistry, it makes a big difference with whom you're playing the game. So that seminar was enormously successful.
Did you have a library at Katona? Did they use?
Oh yes, no, we had a library with the with the, you know, the common journals, say CS, the English journals, the Journal of Organic Chemistry, Bioscience, and a few others. And then, because they came in regularly, they used the library at Columbia as well. But the library was lovely, and a lovely place to study.
Sounds like a Shangri-La or something.
Oh, it was. It was, really remarkable. Lovely place. I have some pictures of it somewhere. I've got to put things like that in order.
Yes. Yes, I don't think I've ever seen any pictures of it.
Yeah, no.
That period of time was certainly an intense one in terms of the kinds of things that you did scientifically, and I'd like to sort of go through some of those, and I'm not sure whether it's easier to do it by topic or in chronological order, but I'm curious. I mean, you started at Columbia in 43 teaching naval students. At first, if I may say, living on the quinine synthesis, but
yes.
But then certainly establishing yourself very quickly with new concepts. How did you arrive at these ideas? I'm speaking in general terms first. I know Woodward spent a lot of time reading Beilstein and got many things from his early days of reading Beilstein, but how did you make that move into your independent areas?
Well, to begin with, as I said before, I was determined not to stay in the synthetic part of organic chemistry. And I had become fascinated with mechanistic understanding through Kohler, which we call, and Bartlett, and Woodward. And I think, as I mentioned, one of the remarkable qualities of Woodward as a synthetic organic chemist was his conviction that mechanism could be applied with tremendous effectiveness and allow one to have control of the various reactions that were involved in synthesis. So that he was himself intensely interested in mechanism. With that the self-imposed pressure to stay away from synthesis and to move into mechanism, I suppose at the beginning I was simply trying to do two things. That is to create through mechanistic, the application of mechanistic, whatever mechanistic thinking one could do at those times, to create new reactions and and then to see whether there were mechanistic questions that hadn't been answered in of well-known reactions. And so the very first problem, I must say, as I go back over it, they seem terribly naive to me, but now, and did just shortly afterward, but the problem that Ruth Alice started on was, in retrospect, a very small problem in which I'd analyzed as best I could in such a way that it appeared that pyridine could take the place of the conventional carbonyl group or ester and so forth in the Michel reaction. And that's all there is to it. Well, it's a very, very, was a very small step. On the other hand, it turned out to be useful. It was a a way of approaching the development of new reactions, which is so commonplace now that it isn't worth talking about. But at the time, not so many persons, I guess, were trying to create new reactions on the basis of applying those few general principles, that mechanistic principles that we thought we knew and understood. And, and then there was a great deal of stimulus at Columbia itself. Tuffy Taylor, what was his real name? I think more an inorganic chemist, but anyway, he was set up to do radioactive tracers, and that stimulated me to think about questions that you couldn't answer without labeling, and so it just gradually moved in that direction.
Well, the analysis, deuterium analysis, was pretty unsophisticated at that time, as I recall. Falling drop method.
It was falling drop. There was no question that meant you had to have enough material so when you burned it, you got at least one drop of water. Yeah, no, and so we got into that and then moved on to radioactive carbon, where I never did any of the measurement work in collaboration with Taylor. But Columbia was in effect an isotope place. Urey had been there, after all. And it's typical of mechanistic organic chemists that the advent of a new analytical technique very often stimulates new questions that would have been fruitless to ask, because there would have been no way of arranging for an answer or a testing of the any ideas emerging from having asked the question. And isotopes obviously opened that for a lot of people. But it was already in those years that I became interested in the so-called no mechanism reaction. And that was just an accident, wasn't it? That Arthur Cope was at Columbia until 1945, so I was overlapped. And one of my students, Lillian Levy, was married to Harold Levy, who was working with Cope, and so there was always a lot of talk about what in God's name is going on in that Cope rearrangement. And that started me thinking about that whole area, and that runs right through my entire mechanistic career, if you will. I mean, it doesn't begin to bear fruit for 10 or 11 or 12 years after I first started thinking about the Cope, coming up with nothing but frustration, not being able to think of anything sensible to do. Everything one knew about free radical chain reactions, about reactions with carbonium ions, carbon ions, as intermediate intervention of light, and so forth. So nothing had any, was involved, was relevant to the Cope rearrangement. So I mean, during those years, but I couldn't think of it, anything to do about the Coke, except tell people that it was an example of a no mechanism reaction.
Yes, I remember seeing that in one of your papers that mentioned it that way.
So that's very, very strange to me that, you know, you can go on thinking about a problem for, well, about a set of observations for years before something finally happens, and it's just the perseverance, I think, and the unwillingness to abandon the problem that finally leads to something.
Well, you overlap briefly then with Cope at Columbia. Did you have many discussions with him?
About it?
Yes, or was
it? No, I found him impossible to talk to. I sort of liked him, but he was, in my estimation, he's a very stuffy, straight-laced guy. Nothing that I would call a sense of humor. A heavy touch, let's put it that way. I suppose he must have sensed it. I don't think he ever liked me particularly. My relation with Cope wasn't as bad as my relation with Hammett. Or Elderfield. Those were very stormy years.
And yet very productive for you.
Highly productive, yeah.
It's amazing in a way, considering the conditions, the environment in which you were operating to. Of course, your research group out in Katona must have been a great relief for you to have that working for you.
Yes, but goodness, the other thing which was fabulous was the quality of the graduate student at Columbia in those days. Beginning in 1945-1946, when they began coming back from the war, older, more determined to make up the lost time, and goodness, I mean, think of the students who came through there. Weiberg, Burson,
Streitwiezer.
Andy Streitwiezer, right.
You don't agree in the pronunciation of the name, as I understand.
No, I agree with you.
Okay.
he calls it Streitwiezer. And Al Wolf, who spent his whole life at Brookhaven and did very fine mechanistic work out there. But what he's best known for is putting together the whole positron emission tomography. And he was a remarkable fellow. Gosh, it was just one after the other. It was sensational.
Well, maybe we should just talk a little bit about some of the things that occurred in that period of time. Had the first resolution of a tertiary aliphatic alcohol, which was very important for later mechanistic studies.
Yes.
Was that a sidelight on something else? Did you?
No, that was deliberately done to gain more insight into the SN1 reaction. Certainly there had been stereochemistry done before, but it involved benzylic stabilized cations, and it seemed to me that one should get down to the basic one, and the aliphatic one, and that it hadn't been resolved just seemed like a challenge. And you know, there were reports in the literature that in principle, you never would be able to resolve a tertiary alcohol. Three alkyl groups wouldn't be enough difference. A secondary one would all obviously have a hydrogen as a small group and so forth. But there's an example. Harold Zeiss came in, and he got his PhD finished in 9 months. I mean, just unbelievably gifted in the laboratory. Really fabulous. And he went on then to spend some time at Yale, where in a really remarkable collaboration with Lars Onsager, discovered the bischromium zero. When we get to the Yale point, I can't help but talk about Onsager. I'll bring it in there. But it was really an exciting time. And then Andy did marvelous work with stemming from that, Ken Weiberg did some.
But the tropolone work was all done out at Hickram.
That's all Hickram. That's right. That's Larry Knox. I mean, the first preparation of tropolone was 2% yield, as I recall, of permanganate oxidation of tropylidine. But that's, of course, an illustration of how you move on. More or you get carried on by work that you're doing. Tropylidine was not so easy to make, and with the and once one started thinking about methylene as a possible intermediate, then and then there was after all earlier work by Curtius on the ethyl diazoacetate and benzene to give what turned out to be tropylidine.